Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Well, I mean, first of all, I go in, and I've been there about a month, and I'm meeting with our people doing travel. And they're asking me about hotels in North Carolina, hotels, wherever, Georgia Tech, where do you want to stay? Where do you want to stay in Omaha? I remember looking at him with his blank face like a deer in the light thing. I'm sure I'm looking, I'm going, well, I thought you had to qualify. And they go, we go all the time.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today's episode, I am joined by Jim Morris, a recent inductee into the ABCA Hall of Fame and legendary head coach at Miami and Georgia Tech. Where do you even start with Coach Morris? We talk four decades of coaching at the highest level of amateur baseball, his time at Georgia Tech building an ACC bottom dweller into a competitor, then heading to Miami, making 13 College World Series appearances with two titles. We talk about those trips to Omaha, being on the losing end of Warren Morris's homer, the walk-off home run to win the College World Series. Tons of recruiting stories. This guy recruited Nomar. He recruited Jason Veritek, Pat Burrell, Ryan Braun. We've even got a story about A-Rod. Actually, two bonus stories about A-Rod, including the one day he spent on Miami's campus before signing with the Mariners. There's a ton here for any college baseball fan. Huge thanks to Coach Morris for stopping by. I could have talked to this guy for 5 hours. He had a million stories. I hope everyone enjoys it. I think anyone who listens to this show and is a fan of college baseball will enjoy this one. Coach Morris was fantastic. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. We have crossed the 85 episode mark, so that is 85 stories in baseball to go back check out. If you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to baseballamerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. MLB draft recaps are up, signing updates, the non-drafted free agent tracker, and of course, prospect hot sheet, all the normal stuff is going on. And if you're still jonesing for some draft coverage, the 2024 draft top 100 has dropped, so there is something for everyone over at BA. And with that, let's talk to Jim Morris. Joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, the newest inductee into the ABCA Hall of Fame, two-time College World Series champion and longtime Miami and Georgia Tech head coach, Jim Morris. Coach Morris, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm glad to be here.
Me too. I'm glad to have you at this time, the very, very fresh news of your, you know, induction to the ABCA Hall of Fame. I'm curious, when you're in the middle of this coaching career that you had, do honors like that, like this, you know, being in the ABCA Hall of Fame, you got inducted into the Miami Sports Hall of Fame. Does stuff like that cross your mind as any sort of motivation?
Well, I tell you, not really. I don't want to say it's motivation, but the fact I probably went to the ABCA clinic at least 35 times. So I went to a lot of the dinners and stuff, and you listen to the guys talk. So I don't know if you think about it, but you're thinking about what they're doing and how they got there. But Georgia Tech, I'm in the Hall of Fame and Miami, so it's kind of along with the Florida Hall of Fame and some different Hall of Fames. But this one right here is a big one, and of course they released it yesterday, so it's been kind of busy for the last 24 hours. But it's been great because I've got a lot of phone calls and text, over 100 in the last 24 hours from former players and friends from here and Georgia Tech. That was nice to refresh our memories a little bit.
Well, I'm very appreciative that you still kept this appointment and agreed to do the show considering the news. But I want to dive right into it. You got a long storied career. We have a limited amount of time. I want to get to as much as I can. I want to start. When did you know that you wanted to go into coaching?
Wow. You know, that's a good question. I first went to college. I was just like a normal guy, a student at Miami, and that's not where I went. But the average person changed their majors three times. When I first went to school, I was going to be an architect. I love drawing, and I love drawing houses. And I still, it's my hobby. I've owned 42 houses, which is kind of unique, along with being a coach. And then I decided to go into a business. And then my junior year, I decided I wanted to be a coach, and really knew that when I was in pro ball, watching and figuring out a couple of things. I tried to learn as much as I could about the game and ask questions. But I also figured out when I got to pro ball that maybe I couldn't hit well enough to stay too long in this game, but I could run and play defense. But you know, you stay in a game a long time by hitting.
Yeah, and you start out, you assistant at App State, you coach at community college. It seems like, you get to then get to Florida State. It seems like fairly quickly. Did that pipeline seem quick to you, or were those years at smaller programs, smaller level of baseball seem like eternity?
I got to be honest. I don't even know what was happening. I didn't know what was happening. I was a grad assistant at Appalachian, so I was doing my master's degree. I was there for one calendar year and got my master's there while I was doing as a GA. And then I was lucky enough. This is my big break. I got a job at DeKalb College. The South Campus started a baseball program, and I still to this day don't know how I got that job, because I was 24 years old and I had my master's, but you know, played a little minor league baseball, pro ball, I just went after the job hard, and I thought it'd be a good opportunity, even though I really didn't know, I didn't have these type of plans to end up at Miami or something, but I went there and I started the program the second year. We're a national runner-up, lost in the finals to 13 innings, and had 47 guys drafted in 4 years. And so I kind of opened my career, and it was a great opportunity for me. We had some really good players, and I stood on the guys hard. They had good grades and went to some really good schools and signed pro. Had one number one pick. I mean, when I say number one, the number one pick a year, named Mike Lebo. I had a lot of draft choices. Just opened the door for my career that, and of course, getting an opportunity to go to Georgia Tech, because we played Georgia Tech a lot. And then I got to Georgia Tech, and people wondered, I had some people who said, what are you doing? You're going to Georgia Tech. They've never won. They've never finished above last. But he got a new AD named Dr. Homer Rice. And people know Dr. Rice as an AD, as a head football coach at Oklahoma and some different places, with Cincinnati, with the Bengals as a head coach. But as a player, he was a catcher with the Dodgers. So he had some baseball blood in him. And I was the only person to interview for the job, actually. And he offered me the job. And he knew what it took to win. And he asked me, and just to make sure I knew, I think, and gave me every opportunity to sell a great project, a great school in Georgia Tech and a baseball program. So that was good. And of course, then you go to Miami where you're not supposed to ever lose the game. So it's a little bit, I've gone from different places to be able to win.
So when you get to Georgia Tech, you're less than 10 years after graduating from college, after finishing up at Elon. When you get there, like you said, a program hadn't won a lot, but that's an ACC program. They're playing top tier programs. Did you come in with a philosophy of these are the kind of kids we want to recruit at Georgia Tech? There's a certain kind of kid you have to recruit. They have to be able to get it done in the classroom, but like kind of kids we want to have, this is the kind of baseball we want to play, or does that stuff all just kind of fall into place with the hand you're dealt?
I mean, I was 28 when I took the job at Georgia Tech, so I was the youngest coach in the ACC, and I hadn't been in the game long enough as a coach or smart enough to figure out long-term goals. And what I was just looking for good players that were good students, and I thought we had a great product to sell in Georgia Tech. And from day one at my opening interview at DeKalb College in Atlanta paper, I told him, and we didn't even have a team, you know, that I wanted to go to the World Series and win it. So that was, I don't even know if I knew what I was talking about at that point, to be honest with you, but I felt like the same way at Georgia Tech and Miami. But I took that job, and I took it on July 1st I think what year now, 1982, I think it is. And I signed some good players. One of the first players I signed was a guy that texted me this morning, Scott Jordan, who from Columbus, Georgia, went in and signed him. And the school starts in August. But people weren't working as hard back then. The game's changed. So I feel like I worked people on, you know, recruiting trail and practice and everything else. And Scott played in the major leagues. And he was a great, great student. And so it was just a combination of a lot of things. But I think I wasn't experienced enough to really know what I was doing other than I wanted really good players. And I didn't want anybody to outwork me.
With that, how do you figure out the recruiting trail at that point? You're a really young coach. There's no perfect game. The internet is not, you can't like look these kids up on YouTube to figure out. How do you figure out the recruiting trail and who you need to bring in to compete at the highest level? And how did you, you know, walk into some of those living rooms as a much younger player and say, I am the guy that you should trust your son to?
Well, the Cab College was the biggest selling point where they didn't have a team, but I was lucky enough that some of the pro scouts, the fact I was playing with the Red Sox, the Mets, a guy named Joe Willingham knew all the players in Atlanta. A guy named Tommy Mixon with the Dodgers helped me a lot. So a lot of the pro scouts were helping a young guy out of pro ball and going into college coaching and help, you know, me send me in the right direction. And back then I wasn't flying looking for players, man. I was driving a car. You know, I mean, I drove to New York and everywhere else. It didn't matter where I was. I was going to go wherever to find players. Did not have a recruiting budget, by the way. Just put gas in the car and went. And just looking for good players. And, you know, I've always felt like I was pretty good at looking at a player and going, you know what? I think this guy can play. He reminds me of somebody. This guy reminds me of Nomar. This guy reminds me of Ryan Braun or something. You know, I'm trying to name. You know, I'm trying to be careful when I name players because I had so many good players. I had like 200 draft picks when I was a college coach. So I try not to name one guy and not name somebody else. But, you know, they remind me of players was the biggest thing when I was out recruiting.
Well, I do want to talk about periodically throughout the show. I want to talk about recruit how you got certain guys to campus. And you mentioned Nomar. Obviously, I want to talk about Nomar. Love Nomar. When was the first time you saw him play in person or heard of him and realized that's a guy you need to go get?
Well, that was back in the area code games in Long Beach State, and Nomar was a upcoming senior in high school. It's changed, you know, back then. I mean, I told you Scott Jordan, I didn't sign him after he finished high school. And then it moved up a little bit. You were seeing guys in his junior year. And the best showcase back then by far was the area code games in California. You had players from everywhere, from Florida, Georgia, a lot of players from California. And I saw him, and Nomar could have gone anywhere he wanted to. And we're lucky enough that I can't even remember all the places he visited, but he was a 4.0 student at a private school. He was a great student. And I think he weighed 142. He was 5'10", 142. But he had a great arm and he could hit. And he wasn't much bigger when he finished. You know, my last time I saw him at Georgia Tech, just a funny story, when I left and I was leaving, it was a junior year in the middle of the year, and Miami, to be honest, just made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I thought it was such a great opportunity. Last thing I told Nomar was that I said, Nomar, now, man, now when you get in pro ball, you're going to have to bunt a little bit more. And all these things. So I saw him, I think, after he hit 25 home runs, and I met up with him. And first thing he looked at me, he said, still working on that button. So he got a lot bigger and stronger and faster, like guys do at that age. You know, it's amazing how bigger and stronger guys get between the ages of 18 and 22. And he worked very hard. But another one of those good stories that to get a kid out of California, I've always had some good players out of California.
Yeah, Nomar ended up, I think he hit a little bit too much to bunt the big leagues. But so when you're, what was the sell when it's, whether it's a Nomar or a Jason Veritek, a Jay Payton or whoever, when you're the Georgia Tech sell, what were you know, did it change kid for kid? Or like, what was really the pitch to get kids to come out to Atlanta, especially kids who lived way out of state?
Well, you know, of course, all of them are different. All of them were kind of late back then when you were getting guys to commit compared to today where you recruit them when you're in a geez, I don't even want to say eighth grade or whatever. Some of these guys, it's amazing how young they are. And that just sets you up for mistakes, which is a different issue. But a guy like Nomar took his business everywhere and decided Georgia Tech was the right place for him to go, combined with a great education, which he's always, you know, worked at. That'd be the best student he could. He went in the fifth round out of high school and made a very hard choice to be able to pass up signing. I think he turned down $500,000, which was a lot back then, and to come to college. Of course, he got a lot more and went in the first round when he finished 3 years later. But in Veritech was kind of late too. You know, Jason went into Orlando. He sent me a video, him and Brad Rigby. So I got on a plane and flew in. Really wasn't right in Veritech, and another catcher I was looking at and Veritech. So I fly into Orlando Lake Brantley High School, summer league program. And high school, Veritech played third base and hit right-handed. So I saw him on his summer league team where he was switch hitting and catching. And I saw him play one game and met with him and his family after the game, offered him a scholarship right then. And within a week, he committed. If I may be wrong, this, I don't think Veritech even visited Miami. I mean, visited Georgia Tech at that point. We made a full scholarship. I mean, he was a horse and got him. But all those stories are different. Jay Payton's a different story. Ryan Braun's different stories. There's always some good stories in your coaching career, different ways you remember players.
With guys like that, like the Nomar, Yonder Alonso, who was on this pod, guys who get that pro attention as they're leaving high school, and you're not only, you know, you've signed them, you've done the hard work getting them to commit to your college, but now you're working against that pro ball money. What is your role during that process? Because like Yonder Alonso, who did not come from a whole lot and decided to turn down some money to come to Miami, what is, as the coach, how do you, obviously you want the kid on campus. You know, you've allocated the scholarship. It's obviously a talented player. What is your role and how much you participate in that decision, or what you do or do not say to the player? Are you selling more your school? Do you ever have to sell against professional baseball? Like how did you walk that tightrope when kids are going through that decision?
Well, it's probably an easier decision for me to try to talk guys into going to college or staying in college after I've been in it for years, because understanding what the possibility is and what the odds are playing in the big leagues is pretty tough. And a guy like Nomar didn't have any money. And as you said, Yonder didn't have any money. His parents came over from Cuba. And I've seen Yonder play before, but I went, you know, there right in his time when we're getting ready to offer him a scholarship, and a little lefty out of Columbus High School named Rodriguez pitched against him and struck him out three times. And Yonder tells me about it. And, oh, my gosh, he's not going to offer me. And of course, we did. And it was a great story. But, you know, Nomar turned – I mean, Yonder, I think, turned down $300,000 or something, which is a lot of money, particularly to a kid that doesn't own a car. His dad's working three jobs, trying to make ends meet for the family. But his dad was the hitting coach for Cuba before they left and got out of the country. And Yonder, you know, just I'm going to try to sell him. I got to tell you, I got to try to sell him on going to college. And more kids are going and understanding just the odds today of the value of going to college first. And I think the pro people are too, and trying to eliminate some of their mistakes, because they always said 95% of the guys don't make it to the big leagues. So that means 95% of the time it's a bad decision if you don't go to college, in my opinion. So it was I would always throw out as much as I could. And the value of an education at Georgia Tech or the value of an education in Miami. Miami has about 180 majors, and whatever you're majoring in, Kyle, that's our best one. That was the one I was selling that particular day, but in communication or whatever. So, I was working hard trying to get the kids, and I believe what I was saying. It wasn't like I was talking out both sides of my mouth. I really believed that college was the best place to go, unless maybe you're a first rounder. I've got a son that's 11 years old, and all I've been through and watching players, this is my first kid, by the way, so I learned something every day from him. But the real deal is I don't know what it would take for my son to bypass college. Just I know the value of an education and development mentally and physically, and being able to sell that to players is something that's very, very important, whether it's these guys or Ryan Bronze or whoever it may be, some really, really good players.
And take me back to college baseball in the 80s, and that during that Georgia Tech run, the College World Series just started getting televised on ESPN, the game's growing in popularity, but you coached in the ACC and you know, it turns out in four different decades. I mean, I guess my, you know, the early part of the 90s with Georgia Tech, and then Miami had that independent.
It made me feel old. Four decades, my goodness.
Four good decades, though. Okay, a lot of winning in the decades. Yeah. But what was college baseball like, you know, weekend to weekend in the ACC? Where, you know, we see now that almost, I would say, a majority of ACC, Big 12, SEC programs, the weekend's typically a big deal, you know, a couple matchups notwithstanding. Was that feel there in the 80s when you're rolling into Tallahassee or you're rolling into Chapel Hill or, you know, Raleigh or anything like that?
Well, I think going into Tallahassee in the 80s was different than going into the other ACC schools, you know, just because they got it going earlier than everybody else and had a great fan base, and just playing there was different than And Georgia Tech, when I took the job there, we had two sets of bleachers behind the home plate and a press box, a block press box with it up high, and stairs going up. And the concession stand was a Coke machine that you could buy a Coke for 25 cents. So it kind of tells you the difference between walking in that ballpark today. Of course, I didn't have that new ballpark that they have now that Danny Hall has, but the game's changed so much in recruiting and facilities. And I look at these facilities, it's unbelievable. And that's just, it's gotten to be such a different thing. Even this is, you know, I've been out 5 years now, just the difference now with the transfer portal and the NIL deals that players are getting. It's just changed so much in how you're recruiting. But I also remember when back in the day when, you know, we had the one-time transfer. I always thought the one-time transfer helped where I was at because I was at a good program. And kids wanted to play where they were in the program I was at. So we didn't lose good players overall. You know, we were getting players that didn't want to stay somewhere else. They thought they could play at a Miami or Georgia Tech. So I always thought that, and I think the transfer portal helps Miami more than it hurts Miami, because kids grow up watching Miami on TV and some of these great programs, and they want to play at those programs. So it opens a door for them with that transfer portal. But it's a lot more than it used to be, just because, you know, it's just you can do it anytime you want.
Mm-hmm. Do you think with NIL, you could have, there maybe a couple kids that ended up going pro out of high school that you might have been able to say, hey, come to campus because you can get compensated a little bit for that? Like, do you see that also helping the schools like Miami?
Well, I mean, Miami's got a pretty good NIL system going there. And one of their alums is helping players. And I think Miami last year in baseball had seven guys on NIL deals. And a great example of that is the basketball, the two guard that transferred from Kansas State. And this is widely publicized. I mean, he got $400,000 a year for 2 years in a new BMW to transfer to Miami and play basketball. Now, they wouldn't have got him without the NIL. And so they're very aware of that. And there's a fine line that I'm sure you're dancing as a coach between the NIL and no communication between, you know, the coaches and the guy that's paying money. But they're recruiting the same guys. And, you know, so it's it definitely helps players go to school. I don't care whether it's Miami or Florida State or wherever. It's helping people go to school and stay in school. And they're not signing guys cheap anymore.
Yeah, that's for sure. One thing, I want to go one more how things have changed and then get back to the career itself. But I'm always pitcher usage. I'm always fascinated by, because with, you know, over the course of your run, we have had You know, an emphasis on how what's an acceptable pitch count and kids being more aware of what potential, you know, overuse is or Kyle, you watch now for the most part, the college postseason, it's really changed because except for some small exceptions, you've got to have a much deeper pitching staff now. And like towards your run, you had to have more guys available to throw because you couldn't. The number one guy couldn't go out there and throw 160 pitches or throw on 2 days rest or things like that. So what the evolution of managing a pitching staff, how much more did that become more difficult with the advent of what an acceptable pitch count might be towards, you know, in the late 2000s, mid 2010s?
I mean, I always was conscious of pitch counts and guys not throwing too much and how often they came back to pitch or anything like that. And I always kept the charts. I mean, when I went to Georgia Tech, I didn't have an assistant coach. So, you know, I was doing everything along with recruiting. And then finally I got to $1,000 for an assistant coach. I could pay him $500 in the fall and $500 in the spring. And that was the total amount I could pay. The coach was James Beavers and had played at Georgia Tech. And he's got a really good job. And it's going on to have really good teams with the East Cobb. The pitch counts, I was always conscious. I was always a big promoter to bullpen. I mean, I've been a big bullpen guy forever. And I think that's a lot of people give me credit to handling pitching staffs. And I really watched Atlanta and Toronto in the World Series back in the day when Atlanta was going up there. And I was coaching at Georgia Tech, and I really was focused on the Toronto bullpen, not the Atlanta, and intrigued the way they handled the players. I mean, most people were there, and I flew up with the mayor of Atlanta and one of the wealthy alumni from Georgia Tech and another guy was a friend of mine, you know, on a private plane to go up there and watch. But, you know, people up there partying and stuff and watching the game, eating hot dogs, drinking a beer. Man, I'm watching the bullpen. I'm trying to learn. You know, these guys are in the World Series. I want to learn. I've always felt like that, you know, I tried to do those things. Very conscious on pitch counts and not analytics, but I always charted every pitch from junior college. A guy named Branch Rickey Jr. Gave me the charts and showed me how the Pirates did it. But even when I was back in junior college, it's similar. But this charts, you know, I kept looking at them and keeping them and you know, to move players around. It's not to the degree that the analytics are today with all the computers, but it's kind of a start to this, to being able to move players around and know what they're doing. And I'm writing everything, calling pitches, running to third base, coaching the box, arguing with the umpires, getting kicked out of a few games here and there like you used to do. That's changed a lot too. It was just a time that the game was changing so much and you were seeing guys that, and if you worked hard, there wasn't many people working hard, you know, just a couple of people. When I'm in Atlanta and junior college, I mean, Clemson was working hard. I don't think anybody else in the state of Georgia was really working that hard. And I was getting players out of South Carolina and different places, but you know, driving and going to get them, some big leaguers. And just it's changed so much now. Now they're everywhere. Recruits are everywhere. You know, Georgia Tech or Miami's got 3 full-time assistants that were getting paid more than I did as a head coach back in the day. And so it's you know, the game's changed a lot for the good, for the good. More kids are going to college, more people are getting degrees. A place like Miami, once we got there, I talked them into making sure they would pay for the rest of their degree. So they would come for 3 or 4 years. But after they played for us, then Miami paid for their degree when they came back to keep them in school and get them to get that degree. Because as we know, most kids don't make it to the big leagues. So I want to make sure they had a degree in their back pocket. Another thing to sell, but it's for the right reasons.
Yeah. Let's talk Miami. When did that job come open? When did it get on your radar? And how difficult a decision was that to move on from Atlanta to Miami?
You know, you've got stories. I don't know if I can tell all the stories, but, you know, story, they called me. The job came open. And Ron Frazier, I had been his assistant on the USA team. And so I knew Coach Frazier very, very well. To the point when he passed away, I did his eulogy. So I was very close to Coach Frazier and his family. They called me and talked to me about it. And actually, Paul D flew up to Atlanta, wanted to talk to me and met me at the Marriott Hotel. And, and at the airport and went over. And I took him to my house in Atlanta. My house was on tour of homes. I had a nice home because I've been, you know, flip-flopping houses and doing stuff. So it was on the tour of homes. I just wanted him to know that I wasn't, you know, living in a shack or on a street. If he's going to get me out of Georgia Tech, you know, it's ranked number one in the country. So I ended up, you know, ended up going down to visit and talk to him and everything. And he told me, you get anything that you need to win, we want you to come. I'll give you anything you need to win. I'll give you anything that football has. And I remember it's me and Paul D, because I told him at that point, if anybody finds out about this, I'm out. I don't want nobody to know what's going on here. I'm going to talk to you, but I don't want anyone to know about it. So I'm standing in center field, and he says those two things. I said, Mr. D, I said, would you please repeat that again slowly? And he told me later on, because anytime I wanted something, I said, remember when you told me, and that I get anything I need to win. And he always stayed with that, with his word. And it changed after we had more ADs. Some of those words were changed, but it was a different thing. But Paul D was a great AD for me. And we did everything we could to win, everything we could to. If I told him we needed a strength coach, just tell me why, and then we hire a strength coach. I think we're one of the first people to have a full-time strength coach, because we felt like it was a need.
When you get to Miami was an NCAA independent for baseball. Football, they were still in football, all the other sports still at a conference, NCAA independent. What were the mechanics of that? And like, especially with schedule making, I went back and looked at old schedules you had, and you guys are in, you know, whereas in once you're in the ACC, you're doing conference play for the last 2 months of the season or something like that. You guys are in Long Beach, you know, playing Long Beach State in April, or playing Fullerton, or going to, you know, really all these other programs. Each year, how much thought did you put into the schedule? Yeah. In, you know, we need to have these sort of teams on the schedule. We also need to have these weekends where we can pitch some seniors and, you know, get some different kind of work in. Like, how much of a science was that?
Well, I don't know how much it was a science, but there was a lot of thought going into it. And I always did my own scheduling. But I always tried to play Texas and Long Beach or Fullerton or any of the schools, Notre Dame's, playing the Minnesota tournament with John Anderson up there, because it was a really good competition thing. I felt things that would help us in recruiting, and it was great competition. The teams you're going to see in the World Series. And a lot of our games other than that were at home. But then finally I got a deal where when the ACC, that the top teams in the ACC, I would play home and home. That's back when I think they had eight teams. So the top teams, your Clemson's and those type programs, I would play them home and home. But the other four teams would just come to Miami. I didn't have to return a series. So I got to keep more home games, because revenue at Miami were always important. And your people come to the games. And it was a different world. And Bobby Crimmins, I remember Bobby is a good friend of mine. We're hired at the same time at Georgia Tech and lived down the street from each other. And I take the job at Miami. He goes, what are you doing, man? This is crazy. You're leaving the ACC. You're leaving, you know, Georgia Tech to go to Miami. What are you doing? And I said, well, Bobby, this is the only way I know to explain it. I said, at Miami, I have my own TV show. The basketball coach does not have his own TV show. Just think about that for a minute and then put everything else together with it. And it's just a different emphasis. And all their thought process was what do we got to do to win? How can we do the things to win? And generating, you know, all the games were on TV, which people didn't have. We were on a couple of different networks before, like it is now. Every game's on TV too, but it was different back then. We were the only one, a few, very, very few schools. Every game was going to be on TV, and a baseball coach actually had his own TV show. There just wasn't any place like that. And then so Paul D told me that, and at the end of it, he goes, okay. He says, now you think about this thing right here. He says, you don't worry about the salary, because if you want this job, I'm going to make an offer you can't turn down. And, you know, so we didn't even talk about it, but then finally it came down to him. He offered me a job, and he offered me 10 times what I was making at Georgia Tech, 10 times. So, you know, I'm not real smart, but I can figure that one out pretty quick that, you know, maybe this is the right deal. And I love real estate. I still love real estate today, and looking at houses, and I've drawn a couple of houses and stuff. And I figured okay, if I get in there and this don't work out, then I'll sell real estate in South Florida. And so I rolled the dice, and it was a great decision for me to go there, to be able to go to the World Series 13 times and have all the good players to try to figure out what they were doing, because I didn't know what they were doing to win, but I wanted to be part of it.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Well, with that, Miami is a school that often reflects the city around it. The roster does. A lot of Hispanic players, specifically Cuban, Puerto Rican players. Yeah. As a white guy from Lexington, North Carolina, like, was there an adjustment process of learning the culture, recruiting these kids, identifying these kids? Like, how, you know, and especially from, you know, 94, you're young, still younger guy, younger head coach versus as it, you know, towards the end of your run, like how did that change and, you know, recruiting maybe a different type of kid?
Well, it was like a fish out of water for me, you know, being a, you know, Lexington, North Carolina guy. I mean, there's nothing in Lexington and, you know, it's just it was a different world, but the real world was for me was inside the ballpark. That's all I did. I worked all day. You know, I got up in the mornings. I was in the office by 7 o'clock. I didn't leave till late night. I went home. Came back the same morning. The same process the next day. So only my world was the University of Miami, and half our team were probably Latin guys at that point. But you know, we got into the third generation or whatever, and Latin guys coming over to the States, and. More and more I saw this, but now today the Latin kids speak much better English than they do Spanish. In fact, parents are concerned that they are losing part of their heritage because they don't speak Spanish, but they grew up in the public schools in Miami, whether it was J.D. Arteaga or, you know, his mom had told him, she said, I don't want you to do any more radio interviews for the Spanish station. You're embarrassing our family. And so J.D. said, my mom says I can't do interviews on Spanish because I don't speak Spanish good enough. I'm embarrassing them. So that kind of gives you an idea. I had a tutor there for a couple months and from 8 to 10 every morning trying to learn Spanish. Like I'm thinking I got two coaches on my staff that are Latin. My secretary is Latin. And, you know, I really didn't need it. And I'm going to a ballpark and there'd be 7 or 8 Cuban guys standing there talking and they're talking Spanish. And I walk up. And because of the visibility of a Miami pro game, you walk in and say, so you knew who you were. Immediately they flip it to English. So after about 2 months, I mean, I had a headache every day, man, just trying to just drill the Spanish into me. And then I'd get on the field and everybody's talking English. So it's I got to tell you, the transition, I was lucky the players accepted me because they knew I was coming to Miami. I'd left the program as number one in the country. They knew the players I'd left to come with them. I was trying to embrace that team on what they did. I told them, I said, listen, guys, it's my first day. I know we got a great program. That's why we come here. I'm going to try not to screw this up. You guys need to help me. And so they kind of liked that. So we were kind of a team concept from the beginning, working with each other. So, you know, from my point, it wasn't tough. Going to Publix sometime was tough because I couldn't order food or something, but not in the ballpark. And that's where I lived.
So let's talk a different ballpark. You spent a lot of time. Let's talk Omaha. You get to Miami and you're in Omaha 7 out of your first 8 years. 2 titles. What about Omaha? And you get to Omaha in three different decades, spanning over, over a 20-year period. What about Omaha was always the same? And what about it was different, in 2016, besides obviously the obvious one, the ballpark?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I go in and I've been there about a month and I'm meeting with our people doing travel. And they're asking me about hotels in North Carolina, hotels, wherever, Georgia Tech, where do you want to stay? Okay, where do you want to stay in Omaha? And I remember looking at him with his blank face, like a deer in the light thing. I'm sure I'm looking, I'm going, well, I thought you had to qualify. And they go, we go all the time. I go, okay, let's stay at the Marriott then. And that's kind of my kickoff to Omaha. And, I had a lot of players that had played in Omaha twice before I got there under Coach Frazier, because you had Coach Frazier, and a lot of people don't realize there were actually a coach between me and Ron Frazier. His name was Brad Kelly, and things kind of fell apart that year. And then I came in. So a couple of my players were older guys, but they were seniors. Some of them were juniors. So they understood, playing in Omaha more than I did. And, were able to help me through that process. And of course, after a period of time, the first 6 years, we went to Omaha every year. And some people joked and called it the Miami Invitational. A guy named F.P. Santangelo, I'm sure you know that name, big broadcaster in San Francisco, but he played in Miami, a California guy. And he just called it the Miami Invitational, Omaha. So that was a great thing. You kind of felt at home. And we always stayed at the Marriott. We always stayed the same place.
We're keeping the episode mostly positive, talking about good things. I do want to ask, obviously you guys are the victim of the Warren Morris homer at LSU. So that game, ends a season without a title, ends careers. What do you, being the College World Series runner up is a massive accomplishment. Every team in the country would probably, if you gave them that at the beginning of the season, would probably take it. When it's ends like that and it's a dagger, what did you say to a team after something that brutal? Because that ball just snaked out of there.
Well, in Miami, first of all, they won't take a second. I'm interviewing for the job. Another story. I'm interviewing for the job and I'm walking in the locker room. I don't know where the players, I guess it was a break, because the players weren't there. I don't know why. Nobody was there in the building. So we go into the players' locker room. And right beside the players' right locker room is the bathroom. That's the door that automatically closes. He's showing me around, but the door is held open with a doorstop. The doorstop is a national runner-up trophy that looked like it had been wet on. And I went, I remember looking at that trophy, and I looked at Mr. D, and I looked down at it. I said, man, it's a tough place to coach right here. And then sure enough, in 96, we lose on the last pitch to Warren Morris. And Paul D comes to my – only time he would come and meet with me was after a tough loss, to console me and support me. That he was a great AD, the best for me. And so he's talking to me for about an hour, and I don't hear a word, man. I'm in shock that we lost, because I'm already designing a ring after we get to second out and strike out a right-handed hitter Robbie Marston, our pitcher, those breaking ball strikes out. And then we move the infield back, and then we got Warren Morris coming up that's hitting 220 with no home runs.
He's got like a bum wrist or something. He's been hurt the whole year.
Yeah, he'd been hurt. And it puts me in shock. I've never had so many nightmares. People ask me, how did that game affect me? I would wake up, this happened numerous times in the middle of the night. I would have this nightmare, and the game was going on, and I was laying down on the ground looking out underneath the stadium. I could see the field, and I could see the game going on, but I couldn't get out, and I'd wake up sweating, and it was that game. And I'm telling you, until 99, I kept having that dream, and it was killing me, waking up in the middle of the night sweating, getting up and going, you know, people want to know how that affects you. Thank goodness in 99 we won it, you know. 3 years later, we won it, and I hadn't had that dream since, knock on wood, but it devastated me. I've never had anything hit me so hard as that game right there, because I thought we had it won, and we'd been there six times, and, you know, we were right there, and I thought we had it, and it killed the players, too. It was tough. We go in the locker room, and you always show replays of Alex Cora, the shortstop, laying on the ground crying. Mm-hmm. And he was. So I get to the locker room, and I mean, I'm in shock as much as the players. Everybody's in shock. And Cora stands up, and Cora's crying so hard that you can't hardly understand him. I didn't ask him to stand up. He just stood up. It's the type of leader he is. He stood up and thanked Robbie Morrison. He told Robbie, he said, Robbie, he goes, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here. He was all American close. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here, and we all love you. So if you weren't crying by then you were crying after Cora stood up. And in the meantime, I'm thinking, I got to take two guys off his team and go to a press conference. And I'm looking around the locker room like, I don't know whether I can go to this press conference. And I'm trying to figure out who are the two guys that I'm taking with me. And it's not Robbie Morrison, and it's not Alex Cora. I can tell you that at that point. And so we were devastated, no question about it. And I hear about that game too much, but I accept it more with the fact we won a ring. Of course, JD was a starting pitcher. Our new head coach in Miami was a starting pitcher in that game. He threw seven innings, and I took him out. If he told me, if I'd have left him in, we'd have won. I don't know how many times JD's told me that. Why'd you take me out? Because JD's, you talk about complete games and pitch counts. I probably got four or five complete games at Miami in my entire coaching career, because we never had any pitchers in top 20 innings pitch, because I believe in developing a bullpen. And I think JD's got every one of them. You know, he was a soft throwing left-hander that located, moved it in and out. JD could throw, he had a rubber arm, and he never threw 160 pitches or anything like that, but you know, he threw over 100 and he'd come back quicker than anybody else and was a great competitor. It still is.
Well, let's talk about that 99 team then. Let's talk about something a little more enjoyable. So you go to Omaha 13 times with Miami. You win two titles, 99 and 01. Was there anything at the time where you're like, oh, this team is different, this title team? Like, is there anything that makes a title team different? Or is, especially then when the College World Series wasn't structured quite the same way, where it's a championship game, it's not championship series. Like, or is it just like, man, they found a way to put it together?
And I think like FP said, you know, it's a Miami Invitational. By that point, I'm thinking we go every year. That's just part of our schedule. It's going to, and I felt like that kind of, and so did the players, which is a good thing, by the way. And even better, so did the other team that we're playing. Felt like, hey, this is Miami. They always win. And so 99, we were ranked number one. The only time we going in, I think, ranked number one. And to this day, the only team that went in ranked number one that won it. And we swept, you know, everything, the regionals and everything, and the World Series to be able to win. So it was a good team. Everybody were pro players, and we had a really good bullpen. And Mike New, the pitcher in the big league, was our closer. But we're playing a small school from North Florida called Florida State. I'm just kidding. You know, they're in 99. And we win 6-5, but they got a man on first with two outs. Man, on first with two outs, and man, I'm having flashbacks to 96. And to get a right-handed hitter, and wind's blowing out to left field. And he hits a long fly ball that just keeps drifting and drifting and drifting. And you're going, please come down.
And are you thinking about selling real estate at that point? Oh, like that ball goes out, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I didn't know what to do. It took so long for this fly ball to come down and our left fielder to catch it on the warning track. Of course, we won 6-5. And so it's what a great win. What a great win that was. And of course, 0-1 was a great win. People always ask, what's your best player? I mean, I had 200 guys drafted professionally, a lot of first rounders, a couple of number one picks. I mean, I had a lot of great players, but I can tell you what my two best teams are, because I never tell you my best players are, because I don't want to insult somebody. We had so many good ones. But 1999 and 01 were my best team because they got a ring. I got one of my own for you today. Just so you asked me about the ring. So with my U on it here, so you can see that. So
it's a good looking ring. Good looking ring. Well, I won't make you pick, obviously, pick between favorites as far as best players or some, but there are some guys I just want to hear about because there are guys who just get to a different level in college. First, I want to hear about the first time you saw Pat the Bat take BP.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, Pat's a guy that visited Miami and was our second choice. He wasn't our first choice at that point when he came in for his visit. And he was good, but he got a lot better after his senior year playing for the team out of Ohio, the Warhawks. And he was drafted in the 42nd or 43rd round by the Red Sox, and they offered him $1,000. $1,000. He comes into our park, and every year in Miami, they're still doing this unless JD's going to change it. But that first day, you'd have a workout, kind of a showcase for the players. Well, Pat comes in, and he's hitting bombs. I'm going, oh, my goodness. I mean, I couldn't believe how good this guy had gotten. And then he's coming to school. And of course, he hit 494 as a freshman. Hardest I've ever seen anybody hit a ball. I mean, if he made an out, it was a hard out. He hit the ball so hard, and he committed on the trip. He was on his way back from the hotel. Rob Cooper, the Penn State guy that played at Miami and coached for me, actually gave him a ride back that morning because I signed all 5 o'clock flights to rookie coaches. And he committed on the way back to the airport, and he wasn't supposed to do that. We made him an offer, but he committed to come. And of course, it ended up being the right decision and for him and for us. And then 3 years later, he's the first pick by the Phillies. And that's the only guy in my coaching career that I ever knew before the draft where a player was going, because Pat was in, he had been hurt his junior year, and during the season. And the general manager, the scouting director, and a local scout, area scout, was in my office with Pat. And they'd come and watch him work out. And so they're talking. And they said, now, Pat, we want to know something. We got two questions for you. He said, do you have a problem if we change your position? Because our best player is a third baseman, Scott Rowland. He said, we may have to change you to another position. Do you have a problem with that? And Pat says, no, as long as I'm hitting. They said, well, we understand the money. The money's J.D. Drew money, which was $8 million. And they said, okay, we got a deal. First pick, $8 million. And he gets the money. And then the story is he's the second leading hitter, home run hitter ever for the Phillies. Mike Smith's one. Pat Burrell's two. People don't realize that because, it's tough to play in Philly. But the guy could hit, and there's a lot of Pat Burrell stories, that I can tell because he got a lot of stories anyway.
Pat Burrell stories are like kind of a tall tale thing that just goes around baseball locker rooms, just the things you hear about Pat Burrell. But with guys like that who come in, like Pat Burrell, Yonder Alonso, Zach Collins, when freshmen come in the fall, how early, like a Ryan Braun, how early in the fall do you mentally pencil it in of like, okay, this freshman is starting from the get-go? Like, what's the earliest you can say this guy's playing?
Well, I never said it to after fall practice, but, I'm thinking, where's Pat going to play? if you're talking about Burrow, or, you know, Ryan Braun was a USA player and a great player that narrated between us and Stanford, and is another story. I mean, he's a West Coast guy, another LA guy. Of course, Burrow is up around the Bay Area, so another California guy. So I signed like one guy a year out of California. Every one of them turned out to be great. But I know Braun had an air between Stanford. He visited schools, Notre Dame, SC, I don't know, or maybe UCLA, but he took his five visits, and they did a big article. He was rookie of the year his first year in the big leagues. 2 years later, he got there very quick. And I remember they did a big story in, I think it was USA Today, and his mom works for Budweiser. And she works, so she was a brewer. She made beer. Well, he's playing for the Milwaukee Brewers. So they interview her, and they said, well, you know, no disrespect to Miami, but he's a West Coast guy in Stanford, and they're pretty good in baseball too. Why didn't he go to Stanford? And it's funny how you remember certain stories. Because she committed to me on the front porch of the president's house. And so we were pulling out all strings to try to get Ryan. And she says, well, you know, he visited Stanford and he visited Miami. So when he took his visit on Miami, he says, because I think he's going to say, you know, he came here because of me, right? He said, he could not believe how good looking the girls were in Miami. So from that point on, every time we had an official visit, we made sure that when we took a tour of campus, it's when the classes are changing. So the guys could, you know, you could see the girls that they were talking about. If that's going to impact the decision more in baseball, we got to make sure they see the girls. And that's a Ryan Braun story, which I'm sure his mother and him would, you know, tell you that's the truth.
Are there any, you've brought in a lot of these guys, a lot of, you know, just in the 2000s first round picks between Braun and John Jay and Yonder and Jamal Weeks. And are there any battles, recruiting battles that you lost, like ones you wish you could have back, or guys you thought you had who walked? Like, who are there any ones that got away for you?
I mean, there's a lot of guys that got away, you know, if I was going to remember them. I've got a very short memory when it comes to recruiting. If we're trying to sign a guy and we lose him, man, I forget his name within 24 hours. I'm just telling you, that's just the way I forget who it was and whatever. If you ask me 10 years later, I don't even know the name anymore. But maybe, who was the second baseman for the Red Sox? The great player from Arizona that played.
Pedroia.
Pedroia. Pedroia's from Arizona. He's got Miami stuff all over his bedroom. He's got all this Miami stuff. So he's coming to Miami. He's supposed to visit Miami in a weekend before he goes to Arizona State and commits to Arizona State and doesn't take his visit. So that's one that I thought we had, and we didn't, and he didn't visit. They talked him into canceling the visit. So I don't know how they did that, but they did. And now guys, you know, they commit early. But that was a great player. But, you know, I've had a lot of really good players. You know, at the other end, an Alex Rodriguez that committed and signed with us and is on campus to go to class his first day. And of course, Scott Boras is his agent. And but you're eligible to sign pro until walking in the classroom. So we're following, man. We're following, and we're going to push him in the door when he gets there. You know, we got to get him in. And he signs like an hour before his first class. He commits at 7 o'clock in the morning. His first class was 8 o'clock. And I always tell Alex, I said, man, you'd have come to Miami, I'd have made you a good player. And he just laughs. But, you know, so you lose guys like that, first round type guys that, but you know, Alex, of course, is there all the time in the ballparks named after him.
Yeah, he made good on the, he at least came through with that donation after the fact.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. I got a story about the donation too, but, you know, we're on the field and we're trying to get a stadium, and Alex comes and talks to the team. And it's a great speech. He's talking about visualization and all this stuff to our players. It was a great speech he gave to the team. So afterwards, the team goes to right field to stretch. And I'm standing there in the dugout with Alex, just me and him. And I said, Alex, I said, I want you to do me a favor. And he said, what's that? I said, I want you to close your eyes and visualize something. And this is right after his visualization speech. I want you to visualize something. I want you to say, he was what the Rangers did. I want you to think you're in the locker room with your teammates. and there's a rain delay and you guys are in the locker room and the TV's on and you're watching a college game, like a lot of you guys do, and it's Miami playing and they're playing on TV and you and your teammates are watching, and all of a sudden it flips to the scoreboard and the scoreboard says Alex Rodriguez Park. And he smiled and opened his eyes, said, I would like that. So that's kind of the way that started. And of course he wrote a nice check and to be up for that to happen.
That's a big recruiting pitch right there. That's a good stuff. That's how you got all those guys to campus. So with that, you have this storied career, and you did an interesting thing with retirement in that you kind of predetermined, you signed the contract extension, and then it's like in a couple seasons, you're hanging it up. What went into deciding, it was time, basically?
Well, it was probably time, and I look back at that, and I don't think that's the right way to handle it by the school or me, by the way, because it kind of left you hanging. And that will end up not being a good thing. But, I retired when I was 68, so it was time for me to hang it up. I'd won a lot. I'd been a head coach since I was 24. Jim Larrañaga, our basketball coach, is much older than me. He's a month older, much older than me. Mm-hmm. I always tell him that. And Larrañaga goes, what are you doing, man? You're too young to retire. And I said, Coach, I said, when did you first become a head coach? And he told me he was in his early 40s. I said, Coach, I was a head coach when I was 24, man. It's the right time. I've been coaching so long. And he looks at me like, you may be right. But, of course, he decides an extension this year through, I don't know how many, three or four or five more years. And he's a great floor coach. So that's good for everybody.
Well, I'm curious. We have kids similar ages, and we talked before we started recording, and you've told me, you help out with coaching and Little League and stuff like that. How much stuff do you get to do with your son that if you were coaching at Miami would not be on the table?
Everything, man. I'm just telling you, like my son's playing tennis right now with my wife. So I said, Will, what do you want to do this afternoon when you get home? He goes, I want to hit. He says, let's go out and hit. So I'm throwing baseballs with him all the time, or I guess about 6 months ago, I'm out playing with him, doing some stuff, and the phone rings. It's Tino Martinez that played for me on the USA team. My wife picks up. She says, and she comes out to get me, and my phone says, she says, Tino Martinez is in here. So he needs to talk to you. So I come in and answer the phone. He goes, what are you huffing and puffing for? I said, well, I played about 30 minutes of one-on-one with my son in basketball, and then we played some horse, and now we're playing football, and I'm throwing him routes, out passes. I said, but then he wants to throw me route passes. So now I'm running outs down the street, and he's throwing them to me. I'm 73 years old. I'm running out patterns, and I'm Tino's laughing so hard. And I wish I had it on video, because my son goes, Dad, you look like you run in slow motion. And that's what I did best. So I couldn't do all those things because my day is determined by what his schedule is. And if I wasn't doing this interview right now, I'd be watching him playing tennis. Him and my wife play tennis, and I enjoy do that. So I'm lucky that I can go and do anything that they want to do. And that's my number one priority, spending time with my family right now. And so all those things are good. And I couldn't do those things because I was always gone. You just couldn't go watch them play. You couldn't watch them do it. And my son didn't start playing baseball until he got here 2 years ago.
Well, we won't keep you from him for too much longer. Really just want to end with, if you could go back and give your 24-year-old self a pep talk taking that job at DeKalb, what would that pep talk look like?
Ooh, I was like a deer in the headlights, I think I said, because I didn't really realize what I was getting. But if I knew what that was doing, I'd probably been nervous, which I wasn't. And I would have said, man, you got to get this job. You got to get this job. It's going to open a job. It's going to open for your whole career right here. It's going to be a great opportunity. I didn't know that. I didn't know those things. And it did. I remember sitting in the office, my first practice, and I'm sitting, I don't have any windows in my office at DeKalb College. I was lucky to have an office. And I'm sitting there, the door's closed. I remember looking at the wall and thinking, I wonder how this is going to work out. Am I going to be any good at this? And that seems like yesterday. And then I go to practice and I kick the gate open to go in and I kick it closed when I left. It was much like a Billy Martin style, because that's old school. And that's the way it was when I first started coaching. I want to make sure they knew I was the boss and I wasn't their friend. And whereas today, and then toward the end of my career, I'm trying to convince them that I'm their friend. Now, come on, let's work together.
I got a quick rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here.
Okay.
Favorite ACC ballpark that is not Miami?
Clemson.
Best player you ever faced?
Oh, how about back-to-back Bo Jackson and Frank Thomas at Auburn?
Oh, man. Oh, so, okay. So you played that Auburn team. We got to pause real quick. So you guys had to face those two guys hitting the same lineup?
Back-to-back. Of course, I had Kevin Brown pitching. That helped. No, that was back-to-back. Nothing like those two horses.
Yeah, that's unreal. Best team you've ever coached against that was not your own? Best team you've ever seen?
Best coached team, Cal State Fullerton. Those guys know how to play the game, especially when Augie was there. And Augie was my assistant coach on the USA team, and they named me head coach. And I said, can I name whoever I want? Well, I named Augie my assistant because I want to learn from him. You know, I want to make him do stuff so I can watch him. Those guys were just machines. That was in 1999, by the way, when I saw them play, and they came into Miami and swept a three-game series, the only time in my career that we were ever swept at home. And they put on a clinic. And then we went and won everything. We didn't lose another game. I told our team, if you play like this, that's the way you're supposed to play, and we're good. And every game went down to the end. I said, you know, we can do this. Let's learn from this game.
Best Miami food spot?
Oh, Prime 112. Best food, best talent.
That was quick, not even a hesitation.
South Beach. I lived in South Beach for a while, and that's the toughest place to get into. But it wasn't for me. Yeah.
Is there a strategic do-over? You would like, if you had one thing you could change strategically in any game you've coached in?
Yeah, I guess so. Warren Morris, a fastball, not a curveball. He had a low and in curveball. I don't even think it was a strike.
I've watched the documentary, and yeah, it was heading towards the shins, and he just golfed.
I mean, our catcher went down to block it. That pitcher's in LSU's office. It's a pitcher, and our catcher's down both knees to block it. It never got there. I got to tell you, I watched the Dodgers when Gibson hit the home run off Eckersley. It's before your time. And I thought it was such a great thing with Gibson and everything. I was friends with Tommy Lasorda, and I went to Dodger Stadium all the time. And then all of a sudden that happens to me. And I'm thinking more about Eckersley that gave up the home run and how he had to be crushed. So, yeah.
Last one. Can you pick a favorite win?
Oh, the 99 championship. Yeah, first national title. My goodness. It was such a big deal. Such a big deal. Unbelievable. And it's just, you know, we just had to have it. Had to have one of those rings. And I remember the offseason in 2000, after we had won it, we didn't go to the World Series. And I'm at home, and the Red Sox come in town to Veritech, and Nomar called me and asked me to come to the game. I was too embarrassed to go outside.
And that was the first time you hadn't been to the College World Series in Miami.
First time. And I was embarrassed. I wouldn't go to the ballpark. I would not go out to the ballpark because I didn't want to face people. And they go, come on, man. Come early and come see us. I can't come. I said, I just can't go out right now. And they're like, wow. You know, but it was. That was the toughest one.
Well, you went back and got it the next year. Coach Morris, that is all I've got for you. Congratulations on your recent Hall of Fame induction. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. It was great. I love the questions and, you know, brings back great memories, just like the Hall of Fame yesterday with all the phone calls.
You got it, Coach. And that's it for today's episode of Phenom to the Farm. Huge thanks to Jim Morris for stopping by, walking us through his career. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and tune in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.